Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by the California 1020. Coming up on Sunday, February 15th, Del Mar Fairgrounds, Encinitas and back. 10 miles, 20 bands. Great post-race concert featuring Don Felder from the Eagles. Cal1020.com is the website. Try-palooza.com. Coming up Saturday, February 21st. That's our Endurance Sports Awards Gala and Weekend. Meb Keflezighi, Dean Karnazes, Tim DeBoom, Molly Huddle, Meredith Kessler, Ben Hoffman. The biggest names of endurance sports will be there. Core Sports, the very best in women's athletic wear, and Function Smart Physical Therapy. Our next guest, she has become a sprinter. Scout Bassett has an amazing background. And at this point, it's the 200 and 400 that you hold American and world records at. Scout, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much, Bob, for having me on the show.
Scout, it's been way too long. We had this conversation a number of years ago. And back then, I think you had just come back, well, gosh, it was a while ago, from Beijing after doing a triathlon there. And really, that was your first time back to Beijing or to China since you were born there. And let's go back to that. Your childhood. You lost your leg when you were less than a year old in a chemical fire, and then were abandoned at an orphanage. Talk about what you remember from those years.
This is so interesting because I just recently celebrated, I guess, the anniversary of the day that I was actually found on the street in China.
Really?
January 18th. So funny because I just saw my dad recently over the holidays, and he gave me the stack of papers, and it was my adoption paperwork, and on one side has the Chinese translation, and the other side has the English version, and I started going through that. I'd never read it. I'd never seen that before, and I was so surprised to see the date that I was actually found and brought to the orphanage, and so that was January 18th, and it was just passed, and it was very emotional for me.
I bet it was.
Going through that papers, and just especially that date, because I went through 7 really difficult, heart-wrenching years living in that orphanage with starvation and child abuse. And
you were never outside, right? You were not allowed outside for 7 years.
Nope, never left the orphanage that I can remember in 7 years that I lived there. Pretty much stayed in the same room. And I remember looking outside the orphanage window and seeing this playground that had ropes and slides and monkey bars. And they never let us go outside and go play on this playground. Instead, they hung their laundry out there. So it was a very isolating experience. We didn't have access to television,
right,
radio, music, nothing. I mean, we lived incredibly sheltered lives.
Did you go to school?
No formal education. I mean, they taught us a little bit of, just language and stuff, but we spoke what many considered orphanage, slang,
right,
Chinese. Nothing formal. And it was a very, we basically every day we woke up and we just worked all day. And that
was when
it.
You say you worked, okay, clean the house, clean the place.
Yeah.
How many kids were in there?
Well, in the room that I lived in from the 5 to 10 year olds, there were about 50 kids. And we did things like washing the dishes, scrubbing the floors, cleaning the walls of the bathroom, which is like a trough, style. No toilets here.
Right.
And very manual things, folding the laundry, bed sheets, that kind of stuff.
Was there, because you didn't know any different, did you hold out hope that things might improve, or did you even know what improvement was?
No, I really had absolutely no hope. I mean, it was a completely hopeless experience being there because we didn't know that there was another world. We didn't know that the way we lived was any different than how any other kids grow up. So I really had no dream, no hope of a better life at all.
What was your knowledge of the outside world? Was there any?
I had no knowledge of the outside world. I didn't even know what a car looked like. I never even really saw the sky. So I had no reference of anything outside of that orphanage. So obviously when I was adopted and I left, it was very traumatizing for me to even step outside.
So here comes a family from Michigan that you don't even know what the heck Michigan is. And basically, these strange people who look a lot different than you, what mom has blonde hair, dad has a mustache and is sort of balding, they look like aliens as far as you're concerned, and they take you and put you in a metal tube and fly you to who knows where. What was going through your mind? And obviously, they're speaking a different language. What was going through your mind?
I really thought that my parents who came to adopt me were people of different species.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
I had never even seen Caucasian people, not even in a photo or on
right.
TV or anything. And so I thought, gosh, if there was ever such a thing as an alien abduction, this would be it. Because I honestly, that's how it felt. I mean,
sure.
people taking away. And mind you that, you know, I didn't speak even very good Chinese and didn't, you know, understand even formal Chinese that well. And so they never really fully explained what was happening to me even when I left the orphanage.
So no one in the orphanage said, you are being adopted by a family from the United States? Nothing.
Exactly.
Here's your stuff. Get out.
All I knew was before, you know, I could even think about it, I was being taken away by
yes.
Caucasian people, getting on a train, on a plane, and coming to a completely different world. And that was it. That was the only notice I really got.
I'm assuming that being parents, the first thought was, we've got to fatten this kid up. Now, did you come with your brother?
Or? Yes.
Now, was he your real brother or?
No. Carter
yes.
is also lived in the same room that I lived
okay.
in, but we're not biologically related.
Okay.
And, yeah, I mean, I came here to the States at 7 years old, and I weighed 22 pounds.
22 pounds at 7 years old. So I'm assuming they're trying to fatten you up, and your body's probably not reacting very well to this.
No, I mean, we started eating food that we'd never eaten before.
Yeah.
I mean, you go through 7 years of eating rice, pretty much.
Exactly.
That being your diet and then the occasional cracker here and there, to experiencing, you know, protein and fruits and vegetables.
Right.
And we never had that before. So it definitely took a process for our bodies to adjust even to the food here.
Right.
And I put on a little bit of weight that first year, which
sure.
was great. And I grew a foot. The first year I was here.
Really?
Just from
being
food.
Nutrition.
Yes.
So, but here you're going to Michigan, and I think I remember that you were probably one of the only Asians in the city, and probably one of the few amputees in the city. So, to a certain degree, you're still a little bit on the outside.
Definitely. It was such a foreign experience, not only just coming here, but I felt like a foreigner even
right.
when I got here, because we moved to this town of 1,600 people, predominantly Caucasian.
Sure.
And I was the only amputee. And so that was a really, I mean, I still got like a sore thumb already
sure.
because I looked different. And then adding to the fact that, you know, I'm an amputee, it was a real struggle going through, you know, that process of adjusting and acculturating myself and going to school. I mean, it was a huge struggle.
So, but within a year and a half or so, you were winning spelling bees in English, a language that you didn't speak when you first got there. So were you starting to have some success, starting to have some reason to feel good about yourself?
Yeah, I really credit my parents for being so committed to adjusting, you know, my brother and I, and also I have a sister who was adopted 10 months before
okay.
from a different orphanage. And so they did a great job of really getting us adjusted, you know, committed to teaching us the language,
yeah.
educating us, and that really helped. And, you know, they did so much work outside of the classroom to help us, you know, catch up because we
sure.
were already so behind when we got to school. And so that really helped me to, you know, learn the language faster, get adjusted, and to do a little bit better in school. But, I mean, I definitely was a struggle because the teachers didn't speak Chinese, obviously.
Right.
Never worked with even a person of a different language,
sure.
spoke a different language. So I think it was just as hard for all of them as it was for myself.
Were there any sports in your life at that point, or was that, you know, like you didn't have enough problems just trying to catch up academically?
Yeah, I think that was it for the first couple of years.
Yeah.
But by second grade, I started getting involved in City League soccer. And
okay.
I only heard about it because the other kids in my class were signed up and,
right.
and doing it. And I thought, I don't even know what soccer is, but they're all talking about it, and it seems to be really fun. And went home, told my parents I want to, you know,
play
soccer.
Yeah.
I don't even know what it is, but it's a sport. And, you know, they signed me up. And I really had no idea what I was getting myself into.
And did you have success, or was it one of those things, sort of like a Sarah, where it's like, okay, Scout, they're going to go play now. You go kick the ball against the wall.
No, I did not have very much success and didn't have success for a long time. I mean, you know, doing City League sports,
yeah.
even junior high sports, even all the way through high school, I think the trouble was that a lot of the coaches just didn't know how to work with an amputee.
With you. Sure, yeah.
And I think they were almost a little bit frightened, just even in the sense that they didn't know what was going on. They didn't know how to deal with a prosthetic. And as a result, it was almost kind of easier to sort of shove me a little away than to have to really learn and, okay, how does this work? How can I help you to improve? And I think it was just so, you know, unfamiliar for them. And that's why I had the negative experience that I had of being really marginalized in sports, not being able to play, or if I did play, it was when it didn't really matter anymore.
Sure.
And this affected my self-confidence in just such a negative way. And I started to see myself in the same way that my peers saw me or what I perceived them to see me as.
Lesser than.
Mm-hmm. And the treatment that I was receiving. Yeah. I thought, well, this is how...
This is what I deserve.
Yeah, this is how people, in this, you know, somebody that has an amputation in this country, I belong on the sidelines.
Right.
And I'm not in the game, and that's really how I saw myself for a very, very long time.
So, Sarah Reinertsen, another single above-knee amputee, struggled as a child and then found sport, found running, and eventually triathlon and finished the Ironman. When did you meet Sarah, and how important was she in terms of you becoming who you are now?
I met Sarah when I was 13 years old in Orlando, Florida. It was, at the time, it was a Paralympic track and field world championship event. And, you know, my prosthetist, who makes my prosthetic legs, had told me about this event, and he said, "Scout, you know, I know you never ran before, but I just think you should do this event." I'm like, "I've never even run before. Like, how am I going to go and do this track and field event, right?" And he says, "Don't worry about it. Like, I think I have some, you know, parts in the back. I might have an extra foot. It's probably not even meant for you, but we'll put something together." So I go down to Florida, and he puts together this running leg. It was quite ghetto in today's terms.
Yeah, exactly.
And makeshift, and I go out and run the 100 meters for the first time in my life. And I thought I was going to die. I mean,
it's a long way.
It's a long way for somebody who's never ran before, you know? And I get there, and that was really my first exposure to other amputees that did sports. And I was so blown away. I mean, women who had both, you know, were bilateral amputees, above knee, below knee. I'd never experienced something like that. And my whole life changed because, you know, meeting Sarah, seeing what she was doing, I saw what was possible.
Right.
And that was really kind of the switch that turned everything.
I remember watching in the video when you came to your first San Diego Triathlon Challenge, and there's, you know, 100 other challenge athletes, they're laying their legs on the lawn, they're in wheelchairs, and that was where the light bulb went on. Because again, you were from a small town, before that you were in an orphanage, you saw that there was a world of people with challenges that you weren't even aware of.
Yeah, I think up until, you know, my early teens, I really thought that I was alone in this world in terms of, you know, dealing with my physical condition.
Right.
And going to the San Diego Triathlon Challenge, at that time I was 14.
Yeah.
My first time there, it really was so eye-opening. And you're right, that light bulb went off because I saw other people who, you know, were going through similar experiences that I was going through really thriving and, you know, not just participating, but absolutely killing it out there.
Right.
And I was blown away, you know, and I'd never seen anything like that. I'd never even saw an amputee ride a bike before, swim before, nothing up until then. So it was really, you know, mind-blowing for me and almost overwhelming because I had never experienced that before. And to see it, I just didn't even know where to start. But thankfully, because of CAF, I knew exactly where to start.
And the sport of triathlon, I mean, you were running, and then obviously CAF is built on triathlon, so you didn't have much of an option but to at least know what it was. And the next thing you know, you're doing some triathlons and doing well. So in terms of your self-esteem, how important was it to not just become a good triathlete, but you went to world championships? I think you medaled at world championships. Then you end up going back to China as a, you know, for the para-tri. Talk a little bit about the sport of triathlon and how important that was to building you.
Well, I received my first running leg from CAF when I was 14. Mm-hmm. It was an OSA running leg, and you know, running is what got me started kind of in triathlon and in sports in general. And that single piece of equipment changed the course of my entire life. I never really saw myself as an athlete, you know, before right. then or up until then. And I started running and, you know, I love the feeling that it made me, you know, feel.
Mm-hmm.
I felt whole when I was running. I didn't feel like I was an amputee.
Right.
And from there, it just kind of lit this fire of, okay, I want to be an athlete. I want to be competitive. I saw, you know, other CAF athletes doing triathlon. And, you know, senior year rolled around to high school, and I was going off to college. And I said,
On a full academic scholarship, correct?
Yeah, full merit-based scholarship to UCLA.
How cool is that for somebody who didn't speak a word of English till she was like 7, 8 years old?
It's really a dream come true. I mean, I never really even thought I'd go to college growing
right.
up. And so to be able to go to
yeah.
college and go on a scholarship was absolutely unbelievable
yeah.
for me. But, you know, senior year rolled around and I was going off to school and I said to a couple of the CAF staff, you know, I need something to keep me going so
yeah.
that I don't gain the freshman 15 or 20. Like, well, you know, have you thought about competing competitively in triathlon? Well, at that time I was 19 and I didn't own a bike.
Right.
And I didn't even really know how to swim. The only thing I knew how to do is run, and that's kind of a problem when you want to do triathlon.
Exactly. Yeah, 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 yeah. A little 2 out of 3 don't exist.
No. And so they, you know, I said, well, would you be interested? Do you have an interest? I said, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, got my first bike through
yep.
CAF and got a swim coach. And anyways, it was just life-changing. And I got involved in the sport. And I think the thing that triathlon really taught me is what it means to really suffer and to persevere through that suffering. Because triathlon is a very lonely sport. You put in a lot of lonely hours, you know, on your bike, swimming, running, and how mentally tough you have to be to do that sport, you know, and to put yourself through the pain. And especially as an amputee, I mean, our physical bodies are not meant to, you know, your residual limb is not meant to live all day in a carbon socket and to be pounded on,
right.
you know, for hours and hours
yeah, yeah,
every
yeah.
day. It's just not meant for that kind of condition. And so to put myself through that, I gained a lot in terms of what it means to be mentally tough and gained a lot of life, you know, skills in doing this sport, and especially friends. I mean, through CAF
right.
and the sport of triathlon, I had, you know, a network that I never really had before in terms of amputee athletes who were also my friends. And that was really, really pivotal for me. And through triathlon, I learned about Paralympics,
right.
really. And, you know, at the time when I started, triathlon wasn't a Paralympic sport, but it is now, and it will debut in Rio, which is incredible.
Yep.
And CAF has been such a huge driving force behind that movement, and that's so awesome. But it was a really, really good experience, and I think it laid a great foundation for me to continue, you know, my competitive
right.
career.
So talk about going back to China for the World Championships, right? I think it was the World Championships for triathlon. And how hard was it for you to go back there?
Well, I think, you know, I knew I was going to be emotional just stepping ground, you know,
right.
in China, and then to have to compete
uh-huh.
In addition to that was almost a bit too much, to be honest.
Really? A little overwhelming.
A little overwhelming, yeah. And, you know, it was 16 years almost to the day, you know, that I went back to China for this World Championships in 2011. And the moment I got off the plane in Beijing, I just started crying, just bawling.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
nothing had happened, but it was just that sense of finally
cathartic.
Very, and
yeah.
I'm home now, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I think for me, the trip really wasn't about winning or getting on the podium, although I did.
What'd you get?
A bronze medal.
That's right, yeah.
I felt really fortunate to have that. But it was about going back, and I wanted to show, you know, the people in China that, you know, I've come so far in my life. You know, I started my life there, and even though it wasn't a positive experience, I'm very grateful for my time there, because the strength that I developed, you know, in living through those years in the
yeah.
orphanage, everything that I gained from that really helped me to have the resilience and the fortitude that I've needed throughout my journey. And so I really wanted to go back and show the people there that I'm okay, I've made it, you know, and that I'm very proud of where I come from. And it was just so emotional. It was very bittersweet. I'm so grateful that I had that experience. Yeah. And I remember on the run course, I had one more lap to go. And I told myself that day I wouldn't cry. And of course, on my final lap, it's just like bawling my eyes out.
Yeah.
And but it was just, I think it helped to bring a lot of closure in my life from what had happened,
sure.
You know, all those years before, and took out the negative sting and some of the negative memories that I had. So it was a really, really good trip, just not only from a career level, but also from a personal standpoint.
Was there any resentment when you got over there? It's just sort of like, okay, that's past history. What I went through made me tougher.
Absolutely. No resentment at all. And still to this day, absolutely none. I say it all the time. I would never trade that experience, losing my leg in that fire, living those 7 years in the orphanage. I wouldn't trade that experience for the world because my life is so much richer,
right.
You know, for those experiences. And I also think, you know, I mean, I don't know what the future would have been like had things been different, but I'm pretty confident that I live a much richer life now in the situation that I'm in than had I just, you know, been anyone else or a regular person.
Right. So track and field. You go from an event that takes, you know, 3 hours, right? The Olympic distance triathlon is 3 hours plus to an event where you're running 100 yards, 200 yards, 400 yards. First of all, was it something that did somebody recognize in you the ability to be a track athlete before you recognized that?
Yeah, I actually never really considered. I mean, obviously, my first sporting event was a track meet.
Yeah.
But I never really considered continuing on with it or being competitive in it until I got approached by Kathy Sellers, who's the high performance director for U.S. Paralympic Track and Field.
Ah.
And she knew that I had come from a background of running, and obviously I was in the sport of triathlon.
Right.
And at that time, I think they were really struggling to get female amputees doing track. And so, you know, she had approached me and asked if I'd be interested in coming to this junior camp,
sure.
You know, for new track and field.
Yeah.
Athletes. And I said, oh, no, I'm not interested. I do long distance. I'm an endurance athlete.
I'm a triathlete.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not in this fast twitch, sport. And but she just kept, you know, contacting me. And finally she said, Scout, I won't ask you anymore, but just promise me you'll come to this camp. And if you don't like it, if you're not interested, you don't ever have to, I won't ever bother you again.
Right.
And I said, okay, fine. You know, just
get out of the way.
Yeah. And so I went to Chula Vista, where the Olympic Training Center is, and I was there for a week. And I mean, I've always loved to run, but when I was there, I really, you know, saw, you know, gosh, this might be something I might be interested in pursuing on a competitive level.
Right.
And I really did, you know, start to enjoy it. And at the time, I was still doing triathlon, so by the end of that season, it was like I needed to make a decision.
Sure.
You know, are you
going
to? I couldn't do both. I was just absolutely killing myself physically doing both. And so I made a decision, you know what, I'm going to try track, and it's something, you know, I love to run, and so we'll just give it a shot and see how things go.
So this is before the 2012 Paralympics.
Yeah.
And you came pretty close to making the team.
Yeah, I mean, not that close.
Not that close, okay. So it wasn't, you didn't leave you feeling like, oh, I should have made the team.
Right. No, I mean, I'd really only started out track almost
the year before.
Yeah, the year before. So it was a bit unrealistic to think that I would have made the team. But I ran the 100 and the 200 meters, and I came in dead last in both those events. And it really, I mean, even though it would have been unrealistic to think that I would have made the team, after that experience, I really had to do some soul searching and wondering, you know, did I make the wrong decision? Because I had success in triathlon.
Right.
And so for me to, you know, leave that and to see, well, you know, I didn't do so well at Paralympic trials.
Right.
And I really took some time after that to decide, you know, what it is that I wanted to do. Did I want to go back to triathlon? Did I want to stick this out for another 4 years? And to be honest, I even contemplated just quitting sports in general, competing. Yeah,
I mean, that's a big commitment, and you had a job with Oser, right? You had a real job. So, you know, you're making good dollars, and to be able to say, okay, I mean, it's not like you're making, you can make a big living as a Paralympic athlete because it's once every 4 years.
Right, and I mean, the number of athletes who can, you know, do Paralympics full-time, not have to work and make good money, is far and few between.
Right.
And so I felt very fortunate. I had a great job, but, you know, I've always just, you know, been a competitor, and I've always wanted to compete in the Paralympics. It's been, you know, a dream. And it is the pinnacle of you know, sport for somebody with a physical disability.
Well, the Olympics and Paralympics are the pinnacle, period.
Absolutely. And so I felt really down after those London trials, really unsure of my future and where I was going to go. But I really credit my CAF family for helping me to decide, you know what, Scout, just because you didn't succeed this time, you know, you got another shot 4 years from now, and you got to get back up and, you know, maybe make some changes in your life. But, you know, whatever you have to do, like, you've got to get back on the horse and try again. And it was my CAF family that really helped me to realize, like, you know, just because you failed once, you know, doesn't mean that you have to quit for good.
Right.
You know, you don't have to give up on your dream. And so I decided, you know, I'd give it a shot. I'm going to commit myself to another 4 years of doing this. And I did. I made a complete life change in every area. Got a new coach. First time I was working with a collegiate coach.
Yeah.
And we laugh about it now, but the day he saw me, I mean, I could tell he really didn't want to work with me. You know, he's used to working with, you know, collegiate athletes who have, you know, are pretty good. They're on a full ride scholarship. And, you know, he saw me run and he's like, this girl's
going to be a lot of work.
This is going to be a project. And I think he was unsure of, you know, at that time, really my potential, but he said, you know, the thing I knew was that you had a lot of drive. And he said, I thought that that would take you a long ways. And, you know, I really credit him for helping me to get to where I am now because, you know, he knew my background as a triathlete and I'm very short in stature, you know.
You're how tall?
I'm 4'9".
4'9", okay. And you weigh what?
About 84 pounds. And so, you know, he was kind of looking at me and, gosh, this is a, you know, this girl,
this is a challenge.
This is a really big challenge, you know. And it would have been so easy to overlook me, but, you know, he said, why don't we commit to this for 3 months, see how it goes. And we did. And, you know, in those 3 months, you know, he really taught me what it means to train at an elite level, you know, in the sport of track and field. And I started a great base with him, and we decided this was a great working relationship, and we wanted to continue to, you know, keep working together.
And since then, talk about some of your successes. World record in?
I have the world record in the 400 meters and the American record in the 200 meters.
Love that.
And two-time defending national champion in the 100 meters.
And for the Paralympics, though, the 400 and 200 aren't an option. You've got what, long jump and 100?
Yep, the long jump and the 100 meters are the only medaling events in the Paralympics. And so
for your division.
For my class, absolutely.
Sorry,
so that's what I'm focused on. And I'm very close to breaking the American record in the 100 meters. I believe that will happen this season.
What do you have to run?
A 17.3. Ooh. And I ran a 17.4 last year.
Wow.
Yeah. So
that's there.
Yeah. I think that will.
That'll fall.
Yeah. I think I'll even break 17 this season. That's my goal.
Yeah.
And the long jump, I actually think that's probably where I'll make the biggest improvement this year, because last year was the first year I even long jumped. And it was rough. I mean, it was not a. I was bad. Let's just put it that way. And this off season, my coach was an All-American long jumper at UCLA and triple jumper.
Yeah.
So he has great experience with jumping, and we really committed ourselves to improving the long jump this year. And I definitely have seen in the practices, I think I'll be a pretty decent long jumper this year.
That is so cool. So one of the things that always, when Sarah first started, you were really the only other single above-knee amputee girl that CAF was working with. Now we go to the events and there's, you know, what, 50, 60 girls out there missing different things, you know, one leg, two legs. Being a mentor and understanding Sarah helped you and you're helping others, how important is that in your life?
Oh, it's absolutely huge. I mean, it's by far the most important thing I've done in and with my life, being involved with CAF, especially mentoring these young boys and girls. Obviously, you know, girls are, you know, special to me, and we have that bond and connection. But I've also made a huge connection with other adoptees from Asia.
Oh, interesting.
In the CAF family, there's a lot of them. Haven and Mei Mei and the Roth girls.
Yes.
And I mean, there's just so many of them. And so I've had such a huge bond with these families because of our shared stories and our backgrounds. And for me, that's really been, you know, such a huge passion and niche for me. And it's so important for me to be able to mentor these kids because I knew what it was like to grow up struggling, not knowing another amputee, not knowing what was possible, not even knowing, you know, that sports were possible. And, you know, it's not about, oh, are you a Paralympic athlete? Can you win? You know, for me, mentoring these kids, it's about giving them the confidence and the self-esteem, you know, through sports, to know that they can succeed and do anything they want in their life. And I have just really relished that role and getting to spend time with them, especially at these mobility clinics that we do with CAF and OSER. I'm very involved with. And I love that. I really love being with these kids and showing them and teaching them. But, you know, what's really funny is, to be honest, I think they've taught me more than I've ever taught them.
Yeah.
And they really are my motivation and my inspiration to keep going is having the relationships that I have with them.
So when are the Paralympic trials? When do you, is that like a year from now or what's the deal?
So this is a really interesting path. This is a huge year, 2015, for track and field.
Do you get points and stuff? Or?
Well, the qualification period begins April this year, and the A and B standard times for Rio have already been set.
Okay.
And or will come out actually pretty soon. And basically, you have from April until about, I want to say, June or August next year.
Oh, to get points.
To hit
the
standard.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
To hit the standard. And then, you know, this year we have World Championships, which is huge. And
where's
it's in Doha.
Oh, okay.
In October, end of October. And so that will be a huge kind of precursor to the games next year. And then what happens is we also have, just like the Olympic trials, we have Paralympic trials also.
Right.
But unlike the Olympic trials where it's, you know, top three and you've hit your standard, you're an automatic go, you know, here in Paralympics, it's, you know, the team has to earn a certain number of slots by people who've hit the standard.
Right, yeah.
And then once you've earned those slots, your federation delegates who those slots go to. And so it's a little bit complicated, but I can tell you if you win, you're in pretty decent shape.
You're pretty shape. Great. Scott, thanks so much for taking so much time and coming in studio. That's always fun when somebody comes in studio.
Thanks, Bob, so much for having me. It's great to catch up with you, and it's been a while.
It has been way, way too long. Thanks for everything you do for CAF. It means the world to these other little girls to be able to see what you're doing. The fact that you're setting world records and American records. And it wasn't that long ago. I remember being at a track meet where you had like a racquetball duct tape to the back of your knee, and you know, like, this can't be the type of equipment these guys are running in. So things have changed a little bit equipment-wise as well.
Huge. I mean, I been so lucky to work with OSER and you know, developing better technology, better running blades. I've completely changed my prosthetic setup to one that's very unusual for a sprinter, but it's what works best for me.
Yeah.
And I've made huge, you know, progress with that. But we've come so far, you know, in terms of technology and, you know, to the point where amputees are able to be at a competitive level with able-bodied athletes.
Oh, I know. Times are pretty close.
Very close. And that's really amazing to see. And it does a lot, you know, in terms of changing perceptions. And it's great to see this kind of integration of, you know, both amputees and able-bodied athletes competing together.
Love it. Scout Bassett has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by the California 1020 coming up on Sunday, February 15th. Del Mar Fairgrounds, Senators and Back, 10 miles, 20 bands. Post-race concert featuring Don Felder from the Eagles, cal1020.com, try-palooza.com, Saturday, February 21st. It's my first Endurance Sports Awards Gala. We'll have Meb Kofleski, Scout Bassett will be there, Sarah Reinertsen, Dean Karnazes, Tim DeBoom, Molly Huddle, Meredith Kessler, some of the greatest athletes on the planet. Function Smart Physical Therapy and Core Sports for the very best in women's clothing. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.